From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in January 2018 in a dining room in Harlem where a group of jazz artists were having a conversation. It was a diverse group which included men and women of different cultural backgrounds and talents, and they had gathered to consider how the country had changed after the 2016 elections and what those changes meant for artists. A bassist born in Barcelona said he felt like he had been living in a bubble for 8 years. His wife is Mexican, and his children were asking what would happen to their Mexican and Muslim friends at school. He says he picked up his bass and recorded himself playing the song, "We Shall Not Be Moved." A trumpeter said, quote, "I listened to Duke Ellington and John Coltrane. I toured with Art Blakey. I'm not going to stand on the shoulders of these guys who struggled to better their communities and then water down who I am and what I think," end quote. And a pianist and composer said, "Oppression is not new, and this music has stood up against oppression as long as it has existed. In fact, all music has done that, and we have to keep reminding ourselves of that," end quote. The conversation was moderated by Larry Blumenfeld, a cultural journalist and jazz critic for the Wall Street Journal. Blumenfeld wrote about the roundtable discussion in a piece titled "Jazz in the Age of Trump." Blumenfeld has written about jazz for decades, and his work often focuses on the intersection of music and social justice. So how can music, specifically jazz, make a statement about society and push for political or social change? It's a question he will answer for students over the next couple of weeks at Syracuse University, where he is a visiting humanities professor. Lucky them, but lucky us. First, Blumenfeld answers that question and more for us right here on Connections. Thanks for taking the time, Larry. How are you?
I'm good. You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you, virtually.
Yes, virtually. You're hearing him nice and loud and clear, but through the magic of what we call ISDN in the biz. Bob Snyder is here, Associate Professor of Jazz Studies and Contemporary Media at the Eastman School of Music. I can see you in the flesh. You're right here with me. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Great to be here.
Also with us is Eric Grody, Director of the Goldring Arts Journalism Program at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. Comes to us once in a while and says, "I got an idea you might want." Why did this one fire you up so much, Eric?
Well, so we thanks for having me.
You're here, sure, Evan. Yeah.
So, you know, we bring in guest speakers from time to time, like every university, and there's a, you know, a typical template. You teach a class, you do a public thing, you get a nice dinner, and you get on the plane and go. I had this pretty rare opportunity to bring someone in for 2 solid weeks, and we have made the most of his time. You know, I tried to pack it with lectures and listening parties and classroom visits and all that sort of thing. And so Larry Blumenfeld, whose work I've admired for a long, long time, was kind of a no-brainer to bring in. And so he's now on campus for the next 2 weeks.
Larry, how's it going so far?
It's going great. First of all, it's been sunny each of my days, which I'm told is rare. And actually, I just came straight from a small, focused workshop that was based on writing about improvisation. And it's funny because what we were talking about mostly in that workshop was the idea of improvisation and how it's been wrapped in myth and cliche and maybe devalued, including, yeah, at a school like Eastman, for instance. I think now there's a certain recognition for what improvisation is, but maybe decades ago there might not have been. So in a way, just the act of improvising by one of these musicians is inherently political and packed with a lot of social history. But that's sort of just one little teased out tangent.
And Eric, you know, I know you want to cede the stage to these guys for most of the hour, so don't worry. I won't lean on you too hard here.
Thank you.
You know, but you admire Larry's work because he's writing about something that to many of us, he's helping distill and explain some complex ideas, how you have music in various forms and how it's linked to history, how it could perhaps be linked to fighting oppression, how it might be sort of interpreted and performed in a modern way. Do you see that as hard to get your head around, you know, abstract, or do you think, well, of course, as we mentioned at the outset and as Larry moderated in that conversation, that music has always been a vehicle for social commentary?
I mean, music just, and again, Bob and Larry here will be able to speak far more authoritatively about this, but I mean, I've always maintained you can learn a lot about a society by the stories it tells itself. And that can be in really any kind of cultural expression. And jazz is one that there are a whole lot of threads that brought it to America, and America has kind of made it its own and then reminded the world about just how exciting it is. But something about it seems to be very interwoven with American history, the best and worst aspects of it, and has really helped tease out a lot of what we do well and what we can do better.
I will also say this is just a product of circumstance on tight schedules, availability, and more. We happen to have white men talking about jazz primarily this hour, but this is obviously a conversation that focuses on the work of Larry Blumenfeld, journalist with the Wall Street Journal, who has had conversations with people from around the world in all kinds of different backgrounds. And Bob has obviously studied and taught. So I just want to, I acknowledge that, because one of the things we're talking about is the impact in different communities and the way music can be a vehicle. But I think Larry has had the opportunity to moderate, to listen, to break down these ideas, to hear them. And our listeners will hear a lot about that. So, Eric, one more thing, and I'll, you know, and then you can kind of just leave if you want. I recommend you stay. I think it's going to be a good conversation. And remind our listeners what you want them to know about anything going on this week.
Sure. Larry, like I said, is here for the next, week and a half now. We have events this coming Friday, and then every single day, each one of them public, free and open to the public, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week. The big things I really want to talk about are the two Friday night concerts, which are half discussions that lead into concerts. This coming Friday, Larry will be talking about the Cuban connection to jazz music with Yosvani Terry, who's an incredible player. He's bringing his quartet. And they'll be performing on campus. And then a week from Friday, Jason Moran, who's one of the real titans of jazz piano today, they'll be talking for about an hour at Hendricks Chapel, which is a gorgeous place, an acoustically really wonderful place in Syracuse. The only other one that I really want to make sure I take some time to talk about is Larry spent more than 15 years now, I think, going down to New Orleans, chronicling the scene. A big part of what he can talk better than I, but is the post-Katrina kind of cultural diaspora of musicians. And Monday night at Newhouse, he'll be giving a talk about, it's called Armstrong in Prison, the fight for New Orleans jazz culture since the flood, which I think will be a really stellar piece of scholarship and knowledge.
Well, you took me there, and so I think it's a good place to start. Because Larry, you know, when you see something like Katrina in 2005, there are obvious questions about whether the city can be rebuilt in terms of just infrastructure, in terms of, bringing a population back that was temporarily displaced. And then there are cultural questions that are deep and important about what is preserved, maintained, what is allowed to thrive, what is sort of centered or prioritized. What did you find in New Orleans?
Well, this is a rich and deep and impassioned subject for me, so we could fill all our time with it. I won't do that, but I want to tell you, what I'm doing Monday at 5 p.m. here on campus is a lecture and presentation, which is really just me spilling out this journey that I've been on since 2005. And it began by writing an essay for Salon, and at that moment in time, I knew that New Orleans was flooded. I worried about musicians I knew personally. I worried about a culture that I loved and revered. And I also was confused because I felt like if one of the great European cities of culture in Italy or Germany that was known as a birthplace of opera or a certain kind of classical music were underwater, I felt that the outcry about just that idea of culture might be great, and I wasn't hearing that at that moment. Year after that, I wrote a series of pieces for the Village Voice, may it rest in peace, that publication. And there I thought I was going to write a story about how musicians were getting back or whether they would get back and how the culture would be revived. And what ended up happening was a long process where first I realized that even though I was a jazz critic and journalist from New York, who thought he knew about New Orleans jazz culture, I knew very little, and I needed to be immersed the way one would be if you're trying to learn a foreign language, to learn what that culture really was, what second line parades and Mardi Gras Indians and traditional jazz really meant as a functional culture that affects people's lives and that defines their sense of identity and place in a much deeper way than we might think, and beyond any sense of entertainment and a music business. And then what I realized was that that culture itself was didn't just need to be recovered, but it was the political action in a moment when people were cast out, disenfranchised, and not being at a moment when their representatives in Washington were suggesting bulldozing the whole thing. And that's a direct quote, not a paraphrase. So, and then it's moved on and on. So I can tell you that New Orleans has in some ways recovered and developed into something that people call a new New Orleans. But there's this odd, strange tension between the city and this culture that that it identifies with, that it loves, and that it sells, and the people who make this culture. And that tension has intensified. And so some of the musicians that I've spent time with and interviewed question, do these time-honored cultures really have a place in the new New Orleans? And for me, I can wrap that into a much bigger idea about, well, what does jazz and jazz culture mean in this country? How do we value it? How do we use it? What does it contribute to our lives and our identities here? So it's a very loaded, and that will be a very loaded presentation by me. It's interesting. I'm glad you read that roundtable that I did, and that was for a magazine that I've been affiliated with for a very long time. And the Trumper you quoted was Terrence Blanchard, who was just nominated for an Oscar for his work with Spike Lee, who scored Spike Lee's documentary.
And to be clear, the Trumpeter, not Trumper.
Trumpeter. Oh, ha, yes, no, nothing like that.
It kind of came out as Trumper, and I thought, wait a second, oh, Trumpeter.
No. The Trumpeter, who would never be considered a Trumper, was Terrence Blanchard. And so when Terrence Blanchard is saying that stuff, and when Terrence Blanchard is making music that may have social and political associations or content to it, he's doing it from the perspective of a person who saw his mother's home completely destroyed, who had to live somewhere else for the better part of a year. It's not a metaphorical rage. There's no abstraction there. It's quite direct. As a matter of fact, you can see the experience of him visiting that destroyed home in Spike Lee's documentary. So there's that. So for me, it's been a sense of discovery, both about a culture that I think most Americans don't truly know or understand, about the fact that it does function as a political action, and is the expression of social justice there, and its relationship with a larger idea of jazz culture. And when I'm here on campus, what I'm doing here is, yes, I'm bringing great musicians here to play great music. I'm going to spend one day sitting down with a bassist, Linda Mejano, a brilliant bassist who has curated a listening party filled with simply music composed, led, or performed by female musicians. And therein we'll have constructed a very satisfying jazz history based solely on the music of female musicians. So there'll be these celebrations of music, but really I'm here talking about and investigating and having conversations about the idea of jazz and what I call jazz culture. And, you know, I think, you know, the music comes first and foremost, but rather than sit and argue about whether a certain kind of music is jazz or what kind of jazz do you like, I'm more interested in what is this jazz culture, because it really, there are communities and they're vital to what the country that I think I live in. So when I bring Yosvani Terry to La Casita, the Center for Latin American Studies here, and we sit and talk about his life in Cuba, his life in New York for the past 20 years, and the inherent connections between Cuban tradition and whatever we might call jazz, and then he plays that music. It's both cultural education, description of the music, but it's also a bit of a political action that says, yes, despite a decades-long embargo, despite the fact that the Trump administration is slowly walking back the loosening of restrictions between the U.S. and Cuba that the Obama administration advanced, despite all the rhetoric about borders and identities, this, you know, this connection exists, and this music, this jazz culture, was multicultural from the start. And it stands in that conversation and that music stands in defiance of the attitudes that would have threatened to cut off that connection. I mean, think about it. There's been an embargo since the 60s, and yet the vital connection between American and Cuban musicians, it's been injured. There have been periods of years where I couldn't hear Chucho Valdez, my favorite Cuban pianist in New York. I can now. But that bond was so strong that it could never be broken by those things. So there's that. And when I sit and talk with Jason Moran, we might talk about how he improvises. We might talk about his connections with visual artists, and we will. But we'll also talk about the essence of his music that carries his own history as a black man in the United States who grew up in the South in Houston and who knows his family's ancestry and has lived in New York City, and how he finds ways to translate all of that experience and all of those ideas into a modern performance context that may be based on jazz that came before, but does not sound like that jazz that came before.
I speak a little bit monolithically when it comes to artists, so I should ask Larry, do you know jazz musicians who are Trump supporters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
we should probably clarify, because I...
No. We live in a complicated world.
Sure.
And people, there are all different kinds of people who have all different kinds of ideas, and frankly, I respect and honor anyone's own inclinations, and I don't, I gathered musicians just to say at that moment for that round table, just I thought we were in a very heated, specific moment where the election of this president had brought certain tensions to the surface, which, by the way, existed long before he was elected. That was an inflection point to deal with things. But I don't want to focus. I wouldn't want to focus too much on that. We have enough talk radio and enough media about that. I think there's a longer history and a long curve of, all arts express life and times, social and political ideas, or at least not all, but much. And it is one important vehicle. It's funny, you opened this segment. I don't even know what musician you were quoting or I had quoted saying this president hates artists. I don't know who that was, but I disagree with whoever said that. And what troubles me now is that, I remember the Reagan years and I remember the quote-unquote culture wars, and we don't even hear about that now. I don't think this president hates artists. I think this president and his administration have no concern for artists and are not interested in culture and do not see it as even important enough to have strong feelings about or to try to wage a war against. And that troubles me more than a culture war. And part of what I'm doing here extends way beyond jazz and way beyond music, and really, I guess my experience in New Orleans, but much, much more than that, has made me very interested in the connections between culture and social justice and policy, and the connections between arts and activism. And one thing I'm doing here next week on campus, which is open to the public, is a roundtable about those subjects, arts and activism, with people from many different disciplines. And I would never come here and be a rah-rah booster for jazz, and I know a lot of those rah-rah boosters for jazz. I love jazz. Come over to my house, I'll play it for you. If you visit me in New York, we might go out and hear some jazz, but I'm not going to try to bring you over to the jazz team. What I will try to do is persuade you that if you care about music, art, theater, poetry, dance, all those things, you join me in being a bit of a warrior for the idea of culture and for culture as an important force in our life. And there are reasons why I may be wrong, but I feel like culture is being a little bit devalued in terms of the things that influence our thinking in our lives, and that maybe it's being conquered a little bit by division. But that's a more complicated conversation. I do think that, you know, if you care about culture, culture is, you know, important to support, and the idea of a culture is important to support. Frankly, I'm a very big NPR fan, because culture remains the not just attention to artists, but for instance, this conversation. We're having a conversation about culture and not just about an album or a product you can buy or a thing you can buy tickets to, or not just an artist and their own personality and their own work, but, you know, what is, and so that's very valuable to me, and I see that shrinking and not growing right now in this country.
Well, I want to ask Professor Snyder if you agree on the culture side there. Things feel a little different or a little maybe less appreciated at the top. How do you feel?
You know, it's tough to say. I mean, as a musical artist and a teacher, I'm constantly surrounded by people who are so enthusiastic about the art that they're making. I'm surrounded by classical musicians, jazz musicians, opera singers. I mean, it's all day long, and sometimes it's 7 days a week. And I think Rochester is a really special community because the community is so incredibly involved in everything that happens, whether it's our festivals or it's what we have going on in our recital halls at Eastman or concert halls. But I find more and more that artists today are so much more socially aware. As much as they are studying how to play really well, whether it's in the Dixieland style or bebop style or more modern type of jazz, they're really caring about where the music came from, and not just from a theoretical standpoint, but also from a sociological standpoint. And for me, a lot of what I learned about jazz and sort of the connection to the culture was I learned by listening to a great NPR station that had jazz all the time. There's a great jazz host, Eric Jackson on WGBH in Boston, and other ones from like WBUR. And it was the stories behind the music that captivated me as much as the music.
I'm so glad you said that, or at least it warms my heart to hear you say
that. Oh, cool, yeah. Yeah, it really made a huge difference. And then I had a guitar teacher that I studied with from the age of 6 until 18, who, when he was a teenager, he was on the road with a famous big band leader, Fletcher Henderson, and he was the only white guy in the band. And he told me horrific stories of what it was like to travel into what we now call the red states. And they would literally have to sleep in the basement of churches and cover the windows up and all kinds of scary stuff. Like, you know, travel at nighttime was a very scary thing in the early 1940s was really frightening. And that part of me just, it went beyond really, really understanding what I had read as a kid about the equal rights movement and all the change that's happened for the better, and to hear like real life stories of life threatening types of situations just because they were in a town, and just to hear what it's like to actually see segregated restaurants and transportation. And it didn't matter if they were entertaining for the elite of wherever they were, people that truly loved jazz, they also truly loved segregation. And that really knocked me out. It really was something. And, you know, later on, I also had the opportunity to get to know the great jazz drummer, Max Roach. He taught at a music camp that my brother and I went to. And
what camp was that?
It's in University of Massachusetts. It was called Jazz in July. Dr. Billy Taylor was there. Mm-hmm. And it was a Yusef Lateef, the great multi-reed player, was there. And just hearing stories from these guys, and it made me want to dig deeper. And my own soul searching in the music started to go beyond understanding how to play better over a D minor 7 chord. And I studied all of my album liner notes, so I would hear, you know, so I'd think about more than just the music.
So now you're touching on some things that are tricky issues for me now, because first of all, what you're saying warms my heart, and you know, I think in Rochester you have a community that it's a very special place because you have this world-class conservatory. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, if I were a young musician training, I would want to go there. But, you know, that's, of course, and there are good conservatories all around the country, but that is, you know, and it's cool that you say that there's a real, it sounds like you're saying there's a real connection between the artists at the school and the community.
Absolutely.
Because that's what you want. Is there a good connection between, say, the classical musicians and the jazz musicians?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's actually really cool. If we were having this conversation in 1965, do you think your answer would have been different?
Yeah, because it wouldn't include an undergraduate jazz program.
Right.
It wouldn't even include classical guitar back then, let
right.
alone jazz.
So,
yeah.
So, but you're talking now about liner notes, mm-hmm. and about stories and you had the incredible luxury of first-hand exposure to someone who could talk about Fletcher Henderson's Band, which was a very important development in American music at its
correct.
Time, or Max Roach, who's single-handedly responsible for a lot of musical innovations, and also with his Freedom Now, Freedom Now.
Yeah, we insist. Yeah,
we insist.
Right.
Made one of the most powerful and overt political statements in jazz's history, I think. But you know, I just this morning met someone who told me that they had downloaded from Spotify an album that I think is important that I wrote the liner notes to. And of course, if you download from Spotify, you will not get my liner notes. You will not even be informed of the existence of my liner notes. So that music, that, you know, you're as the listener, as the consumer, your access to that history and that context is gone. It's erased. And that line, so, you know, I mean, you're a trained musician who's had some very privileged access by virtue of your training, your talent, your exposure. But I think a lot of people, and for instance, the stories that I wrote 10 years ago in the Village Voice about a real context to New Orleans culture and what was going on, well, the Village Voice does not exist anymore. And yeah, I could go somewhere else, but I think we're losing a lot of the vehicles and the ways in which people learned about the context to the music.
I think you're absolutely right. And
And that troubles me. I mean, it troubles me personally, professionally, in terms of my work and its viability, but on a much deeper level, you know, you and your students have the have the luxury and also the drive for that kind of immersion. But I want, you know, was this morning someone was talking about Roy Hargrove's album Creole, which won a Grammy, important trumpeter, resulted from a trip to Cuba, and I wrote the liner notes to it. And you know what? There's a story there about how this young American trumpeter who was on the rise worked with very significant Cuban musicians, and how that relationship took shape and what it meant. And, you know, it exists just as music, but it should also exist as that story. So that kind of, I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but that troubles me.
And just to sort of put a bow on the point I had made from the outset, so Producer Megan Mack sends along the fuller context here. When I mentioned right at the top of the hour here that there's been discussion in the artist community about whether this administration actually hates them, I'm drawing on a couple of things. You with some routine, do see members of this administration telling artists to shut up, to stop talking, that no one cares about what they think about various issues. And Larry Blumenfeld, our guest from the Wall Street Journal this hour, wrote a piece in 2017 for the Daily Beast called "Can the Arts Keep Borders and Minds Open in Trumpian Times?" and quoted Tanya Selvaratnam from the Federation, who said that this administration is frankly terrified of artists and is routinely telling artists to shut up. And so maybe hates the wrong word, but maybe feels threatened by artists. And I'm just curious, Larry, is that an indication of the power of artists? That if you've got political leaders who feel like they've got to try to get those voices quieted down?
Well, that piece in particular was me focusing on this organization that Laurie Anderson and Tanya and a few other artists began. And what they were trying to do was really smart, I think, and there are other efforts like this afoot, to really kind of build a network of artists and people who are in the arts who could somehow be connected and discuss, well, how are we not coordinating our efforts as much as sharing our expressions and our resources to have the political statements or the responses to politics be more resonant. And that's one thing. I disagree with her, frankly. As I said, I don't think this administration, I honestly don't want to harp too much on Trump and this administration, but I think this president and this administration don't hate artists and don't fear them. I think they dismiss them. I think, you know, the shut up, I think, has been directed more at famous athletes and famous actors and people who just have a very big platform. But I can tell you from my own experience as a reporter, after 9/11, there was a tremendous chill felt throughout all creative communities, a tremendous chill. Nothing, there was no McCarthyism, but the depth and power of the nationalism that was being felt there, and the feeling that anything speaking out in opposition to, say, the Iraq War or the Bush administration was seen as so unpatriotic, and things like jazz were cloaked in so much nationalist fervor, which I think if you watch Ken Burns' series, you get that sense, his famous PBS series, that it became almost a bit of a fundamentalism. And I know I spoke with many artists who felt like they couldn't speak out or shouldn't speak out or were counseled not to because it would affect their careers. And it did affect their careers. And so I can speak mostly for the jazz and creative music community that I'm connected to, but there were two things. There was a chilling effect to, you know, the potential bad effects of speaking out. And at the same time, there was tremendous pressure to conform to a mainstream standard. And there were career and money implications hanging in the balance with those things. I think now, frankly, as powerful and strong and one-sided as the rhetoric of the right is, and the rhetoric of those who would say, you know, feel this way about immigration or something like that is, or the racist rhetoric is, we're past the point of a chilling effect. I think, you know, what we see with Black Lives Matter, what we see with the Me Too movement, what we see in general, there is plenty of speaking out. There is plenty of activism. There is plenty of candor. And I think that I've found in my work that in the jazz community, but also across the board in the artistic communities, people are being more creative about how to speak out, and they're being more forceful about it, either through their art or aside from their art. Now, I think that social media and the internet has helped with that, and that's one good effect. However, I think that social media and the internet also feed the problem I was talking about before of removing the art from its context. So I find that most people who say, listen to music, download music and they find out about things through the internet or social media, and they don't get the context and they don't read that much. I don't think people read as much as, say, a generation ago read in Rolling Stone or in their daily newspaper. And just the quantity and depth of the coverage in newspapers has diminished purely due to economics. Hmm. So, but back to your original point, I think artists are speaking out more and more effectively than ever.
I agree. I think that, you know, even if you go back to the late 1950s with artists like Charles Mingus and some of the recordings that Max Roach did, where he, like, you know, directly, you know, one of his songs that he co-wrote with Abby Lincoln, Mendacity, and that's from the early 1960s Impulse record. It's that album is escaping me, and then another one of his records where, you know, direct reference to Marcus Garvey. The thing about recorded music is it has a permanence, and I feel on the, you know, in terms of social media, it's such a flash in the pan to say something. And I think when artists perform something that's meaningful, whether it's a live performance or something that is recorded for history, that social awareness, I think, stays there. And I think for jazz musicians, it's very emotional to try to convey that level of social awareness and context with something that doesn't have words. So you're trying to create that imagery from the music, drawing upon artistry and theory and chords and rhythms. So, you know, sometimes it's a lot more of a direct connection if you have, you know, the imagery of Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, which is about, you know, the tragedy of lynchings in this country. But I do agree with what you're saying about definitely kind of a disconnect, and people are reading less. People are not as connected to art in general, and that's, as an artist, that kind of scares me. I mean, there's definitely very, very, very serious jazz fans, and during the jazz festival, we see, you know, a much higher percentage of them concentrated in downtown Rochester, and I always wished that, you know, more of those people would stay connected to the music year round, not just over 9 days.
Well, I'm looking at the clock going, oh my gosh, it's 1:44, which Eric Grody told me the conversation would fly. So we have to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back in just a moment. You heard Bob Snyder, professor of jazz studies and contemporary media at the Eastman School of Music, and Eric Grody is here, director of the Gold Ring Arts Journalism Program at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. And with us via ISDN from the Wall Street Journal is Larry Blumenfeld, who is spending a couple of weeks here, and more to tell you about his visit and what you ought to know, and a lot more to get to with Larry after the other side of this break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On the next Connections on Thursday, did you see the new survey about the most tolerant American cities? A city in New York State was on the list. We're talking about sort of tolerating political differences. But hold on. We're going to talk about some flaws in the methodology and trying to understand who really is tolerant of their neighbors with different ideas and how to get there. That's Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Michael writes to the program to say liner notes was one of the great joys of buying records. And Bob Snyder's got his arms up in triumph at that. But I hope I was somewhat nostalgic for that, but I would love to see us continue with this sort of a tradition. I mean, you're celebrating liner notes, Bob.
Yeah, liner notes is where I learned about jazz history. Liner notes is where I learn about the intent of the artist and the arrangements, and put me in touch with so many great historians of jazz, like Nat Hentoff, Ira Gittler, and I became a self-professed, absolute jazz fanboy, geek. If there was a jazz trivia show, I think I could come close to winning from reading liner notes.
Just the liner notes.
Just the liner
just
notes.
Just the Jeopardy, yeah. Jazz season, you would have killed on it.
And it also, for budding artists, it also puts you in touch with, you know, if you listen to a song that is on YouTube or other places, you don't even know who the composer is. You might not know the year it was written. In some cases, you know, I've had students say to me, you know, I learned this this Grant Green guitar solo for today's lesson, and you know, I'll say, well, okay, do you know which record that's on? Do you know who are the sidemen on the record? Are you, you know, do you know where that is within his work? You know, it's so prolific, right, on Blue Note Records. And you know, it's just like, no, I just learned it. It's a really cool guitar solo. I got some cool vocabulary from it, and I'm a firm
now,
believer.
Now there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with that musician getting some vocabulary,
right,
and getting those riffs down. But yeah, you're right. Divorced from any context, it's just something you can learn to play. So you were one of those guys, I guess, who would go to the record store, and even if you weren't buying it, you'd be reading the liner notes and opening them up and reading the gatefold liner notes and that kind of stuff.
And buying a lot.
Right, but that's, you know, we had this constant devaluation. So there was a time, and I'm glad you mentioned Nat Hentoff, because he actually was a friend and mentor of mine, and he sort of was a model for me in terms of, hey, I can write about this music with expertise and precision, but I can also have it be my writing about it be inherently political in a way that reflects what's inherently political about these lives. And Nat was very out front about doing that.
Great.
And I've always felt like I wanted to keep that flame going. But yeah, there was a day when, you know, you pick up an old Blue Note album, an old Prestige album, you can read the liner notes. You could read it in the store and learn that stuff and decide whether you wanted to buy that. Okay, flash forward to maybe 1999. Now it's on a compact disc, and you must make the purchase first before you can slide that little paper out and read the liner notes. And even then, you'll be reading it in 8-point type, so, well, you'll really have to want to read it. And now, flash forward to now, yeah, will you ever even have it if you don't have it physically? So, you know, I mean, hey, maybe one day there'd be an outcry of Spotify users that convinces the company that they should at least make you aware and give you a link. But I highly doubt that will happen, or that it would fit their business plan. When it comes to jazz, you know, I'm sure if you were digging all those albums, well, it was never only about Grant Green. It was never only about Max Roach. Who else was on the date?
That's right.
Sidemen. The entire history of jazz is largely embedded in the personnel on each album and the personnel on each band. Well, which band was John Coltrane in at this time? Who was in Miles's band at this moment? Who played on Kind of Blue, and where did their careers go after that? A lot of that information, just who the personnel is missing from a lot of these downloads, and certainly from YouTube. And it's also, you know, let's not go too far down the rabbit hole of that problem.
Right.
But, you know, the idea of, you know, there is a musicological and historical context that, right, for you as a music teacher, as a professor and a musician, and with young musicians, you want them to have that context just so they'll understand it as intelligent musicians. And then there's a larger context of, you know, that Nat Hentoff might have written about in a liner note about what was going on in the world and in this musician's life at the time he made this music. You know, you could spend all day listening to late John Coltrane solos and transcribe them and try to learn them. But if you don't understand what he and his wife were doing in terms of their spiritual life, if you don't understand his immersion into Indian music, and you don't understand the politics that even if he wasn't speaking about them, he was conscious of, you're missing much of the equation there, or at least you're being robbed of it.
Well, in our last few minutes here, I do want to ask our guests, and Larry, I'll start with you. What is maybe the current music or current story in your world that you find the most compelling right now?
That's a deep question, but I'll try to give you a short answer, which is all right, last night I gave a lecture on the AACM, an organization started in Chicago 50 years ago that most people associate with the avant-garde. The story is much deeper and much broader than that. And I would say that if you're in New York now around the jazz and creative music scenes, the most compelling influences and the greatest driving aesthetic forces are more closely associated with, say, the AACM than with, say, the neo-traditionalist mainstream movement of 20 years ago. So I guess what I'm saying is, if you're looking for any next big style that you can name, you're not going to get it. And if you're looking for, you know, where mainstream jazz is going, where it's going is it's absorbing all these things that we used to consider out or avant-garde or maybe even outside the frame of jazz, and how they're being distilled into what jazz was and, you know, keeping it vital that way. So it's both exploding, but also for, you know, that and it's not that diversity and that blend, that mixture is the thing. It's not hybrid. It is. And you know, I think that's both exciting in terms of listening to music, but it's also a really powerful metaphor for the moment we're living in and how we, you know, how we might want to resist certain ideas of our identity.
Yeah, what an interesting comment there, Eric.
I'd just like to mention, Larry and Bob have both spoken very eloquently about how jazz has, and people's appreciation and understanding of jazz is, you know, is at risk of sliding off to the side or becoming a bit marginalized. Like I mentioned, we usually don't have speakers who can come for as long as Larry is. If I hadn't mentioned before, Larry is, it's called the Jeanette K. Watson Distinguished Visiting Professorship in the Humanities. Now, people in the past who have been this Watson professor at Syracuse have been Saul Bellow and Toni Morrison and Noam Chomsky and people like that. So I think just the fact that the Humanities Center at SU, which has been very supportive and very generous to bring Larry in to talk about these exact issues and topics, shows that, I mean, they sense rightly that there are people who really think there's a lot to be gained by thinking about this stuff and talking about this stuff and nudging it back into the middle of the conversation.
Bob, what stands out to you in terms of stories that are the most compelling right now?
There's unbelievable compelling things that we see in the news every day. I think I have to always tell myself to keep my focus on the music, keep my focus on family, my students, and some of the stuff that Larry was talking about. You know, it's in our walls of the school every day, sort of this mashup of the all of the great styles that have been happening in jazz, and they just continue to, you know, the lines blur between what is really avant-garde and what's out and what's traditional. And I would encourage anybody that's around this area, when you see our students performing, usually for free, come on out. Or if you have the opportunity to experience live jazz instead of experiencing it on YouTube, please come on out. And one thing I was thinking about when I came in here today, when we were talking about jazz and social justice and awareness and advocacy, there was a triple Grammy award-winning artist, John DeVersa, from, he teaches at University of Miami. My nephew has him as a prof, and his record is called Dreamers. And not only does it celebrate dreamers, but he includes them musically, and you hear their voices.
Wow.
And I've been digging that record a whole lot lately. And I listened to a live performance because my nephew was playing trumpet. And, you know, and it's extremely patriotic, too. And that's the one thing I want everybody to think about, too, is that jazz artists tend to be very socially aware, but it doesn't mean we don't love where we are.
What a great story. What's the name of the album again?
It's John Daversa, D-A-V-E-R-S-A. I believe it's called Dreamers.
I want to thank Larry Blumenfeld for being with us for the hour. Thanks for taking the time. I hope you enjoy your stay up here in sunny upstate and western New York. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Our thanks to Bob Snyder from the Eastman School of Music. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Grody is the director of the Golding Arts Journalism Program at the Newhouse School at Syracuse. You want to mention one thing real quick?
Just to get on the thruway and come out to Syracuse next week and a half. We've got a lot of events.
A lot of events coming up here, and you've heard about them this hour. Thank you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
Our thanks to John Andrus, engineering today, Don McDonald, volunteer, Megan Mack, producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.